Depends how long it takes those sons of dogs to put in the pump for your new boiler. Although tempted to ask why he employed sons of dogs, who he clearly felt were not up to the job, Eggman didn't. Instead he said, "I'm trying to look up something on my son's computer. It's important." The man shook his head. "Sorry, can't help you. These things take as long as they take." Fatma, who was standing by the cooker, looked furiously at her husband, and then smiled at the gas-fitter.
"Well, Ali Bey, I understand," she said, "and I think you're all doing a wonderful job."
"Oh, thank you, Fatma Hanum," he said with a bow. Chetin Eggman rolled his eyes. Both his wife and the gas-fitter saw him. Fatma pursed his mouth.
"Don't you roll your eyes at me, Chetin Eggman," she said. "You're the one who shouldn't be here, not this gentleman. If you want to work, go to work. Don't stay here and get under everyone's feet."
Amazed at how vehement this woman was being with her husband, and fearful of witnessing a domestic, the gas-fitter left the kitchen quickly. "Whatever happens, you're getting your precious central heating, Fatma," Eggman said. "It's summer, in case you've not noticed, and so there's no urgency, is there?" She moved towards him like a small, grey-haired fury.
"You've never wanted this central heating, have you?" she said. "Rather stick with that disgusting old wood-burning soba."
"Well, it nearly broke my back last year," she said.
"We're having it, and we're having it now."
Then she whispered,
"Do you know how difficult it is to first get and then keep workmen these days? They all want to work for the big developers now. They look down on small jobs like this."
"Yes, yes, I know all about that," he said. He lit a cigarette. She wasn't wrong, but that didn't make his situation any easier. "And so I suppose I'll have to try and work in my noisy, hideously smoke-free, infuriating office."
"That has secure internet access?" Fatma said.
She shook her head.
"I went to the prayer area behind Hagia Sophia yesterday, and look how I have been rewarded now. These workmen coming are a gift."
Eggman shook his head. "I wish you wouldn't pray at Hagia Sophia," he said. "It's a museum."
"Maybe not for much longer."
"You want another war with Greece, do you, Fatma?" Eggman said. "Remember your cousin Husnu died in Cyprus in 1974?
"Yes, but we won that war, didn't we?" she said. "The Greeks won't do anything, Chetin. Not now. Anyway, you should be glad that I went out."
He was always telling her that she didn't get out enough. He feared that being indoors all the time was a sign of increasing religiosity.
"I even met a man when I was on my way to the prayer area yesterday," she said proudly.
Eggman rolled his eyes again. She made it sound like bungee jumping, unusual and exotic. "Who was that, then?"
"Old Huckabee. You know, the one who looks after the Greek woman."
Eggman's ears pricked up.
"He was with his son, Lockman, and a grandchild. They were visiting. You know, Lockman's new wife has had 3 children in 3 years,
Fatma said.
"I wish our daughters were more keen to have babies. None of them have more than 2. What can you do?"
Eggman hadn't seen Lockman when he'd gone out to the Negroponte house. But then maybe he and the child had gone back to Harker's own home, wherever that was. Because he had always spent so much time at the Negroponte house, it was easy to forget that Harker had a place of his own. What Fatma said to him then, Eggman didn't know. He only caught the last bit.
"Well, are you going to your office or not?"
He went. As he left, he said, "I'll be back when I'm back." Fatma didn't answer. Ahmed Erden put his phone down on the passenger seat of his car and put his head in his hands. He knew it was cowardly and selfish, but all he could think about was fucking Gulizar. In the car it could take him hours to get over the Bosphorus to Muda. He needed her now. He put a hand on his chest and tried to control his breathing so that he could think clearly. If he drove down to Karaköy, he could put the car in a parking garage and get a ferry, then a taxi to somewhere near Gulizar's apartment. That way he could be over there within the hour. And the sooner he was over there, the sooner he was back on the European side again, to his real life. In the meantime, he realized he needed to eat. If he didn't eat, he couldn't inject himself, and that could prove fatal. By 4 p.m., Nurettin and the rat boy had enough money for their various entertainments, and the kid had scooted off to see his dealer. Nurettin, at a rather more leisurely pace, made for the bars on Nevizade Sokak, a small but lively alleyway branching off from the ancient Biolo fish market on Istiklal Caddesi. Hidden in even smaller courts and alleys in the twisted streets roundabout, Nurettin occasionally caught sight of a church, Greek or Armenian, silent reminders of the communities who had once lived in that area. If he'd wanted to, he could have had something to eat. There were some nice small restaurants in the area. But that wasn't the mission for Nurettin. He found a bar that was a bit more down at heel than the others, sat outside on a stool, and when the waiter came, he ordered a bottle of rakı. The slightly harsh aniseed spirit, mixed with just enough water to make it cloudy, went down like silk. He'd bought a packet of cigarettes on the way up Istiklal, too, and so Nurettin was entirely at peace with himself and his fellow man for many happy hours. However, at some point a sort of time shift happened, and Nurettin went from being contented on his stool in the late afternoon sunshine to being in a puddle of his own vomit in neon-punctuated darkness. The bar had gone, and all he could smell, apart from vomit, was fish. As he attempted to sit up, his hand slid about on slime and scales, which seemed to be all over the rough pavement beneath him. Then a cat came along and sniffed his feet. He told it to fuck off. A man, a fish vendor, by the look of his apron, said, "You best move along, brother. The police will be here in a minute picking up people like you." "What do you mean by that?" Nurettin said. "People like what?" "People have had too much to drink," the fish vendor said. "I haven't had to, brother. You were brawling with a man, which was why they threw you out of the Aphrodite bar." Nurettin didn't remember any brawling. He didn't remember leaving the bar, or even what its name had been. Had any of that happened? Or was this man just delighting in obliquely calling him an alcoholic? Nurettin got up shakily. "I'm no alcoholic," he said. "I'm a true believer. I just have problems." "We all have those," the man said. "Not all of us try to solve them by drinking a bottle of rakı and then trying to smash glasses in people's faces."
"What do you mean? I didn't do that."
"Yes, you did," the man said. "Luckily, the man you ended up fighting was even drunker than you were, and so he just reeled away. Now you need to go home." Nurettin flared.
"Don't tell lies," he said. "You're only picking on me because I'm poor. It's all right for you, with your own business, and your nice home to go to, and your wife, and—" "Will you just leave?" the fishman said. "I mean you no ill will."
He put a hand on Nurettin's shoulder. It proved to be a mistake.
"Don't you touch me, you bastard!"
Nurettin pushed the man's hand away from him, and then slapped his face.
"Don't you dare, you little shit!"
For a moment the fishman just stood and looked at him. Had Nurettin not followed through with a punch to the man's mouth, he would probably have let the slap go. But the punch was too much. The fishman hit back, and Nurettin socked him in the stomach. Equally matched, one small and weak, while the other was as drunk as a sailor, they fought in almost silence, sometimes not even making contact with each other. But it was enough to alert the fishman's neighbors, who went and got the police who were standing at the bottom of the market. When an officer finally pulled Nurettin off the fishman, the rubbish picker hardly knew what his own name was, let alone what he'd done or where he was. Chapter 14. Thimber Hanum had been insistent.
"Come on," she'd said to Sinem when she'd got her out of bed that morning. "I've cleared it with Kerim. We're going to Gezi."
Sinem had looked confused. She'd had a lot of pain in the night, and had only managed to get through it by reading the book by Josephine Tilly, as requested, that Kerim had bought her. Consequently, the skin underneath her eyes was black, and her face was as pale as the moon.
"Our glorious leader has gone on his foreign trip, and so nothing will happen until he gets back,"
Pember said. The police won't make a move without his say-so, and there are rumours that the President is ready to make concessions. If you don't come now, you'll regret it. They went, Sinem in a wheelchair, pushed by Pember, which had a rainbow flag tied to the back. When they arrived, they were greeted by Pember's very effusive American friend, Rita, as well as by a very heavily made-up elderly woman. The American, whose Turkish wasn't bad after 10 years as a hostess in Istanbul, introduced her friend.
"This is Samsun," she said. "She knows everyone. Samsun, this is Pember and Sinem."
The older woman held out her hand to the younger ones, as if she might want them to kiss it.
"Sinem is married," Rita made speech marks with her fingers, "to a policeman, and so we're pretty safe around her. He'd call you if anything bad was going to go down, wouldn't he, honey?"
"Yes."
There was more noise than Sinem was used to, loud music, people's voices, and even, when they'd first come into the park, a woman belly dancing while people clapped. She was overwhelmed and found it hard to be anything more than monosyllabic. Later, Pember would tell her off. She'd say, "There's no need for you to be like that. You need to have more confidence in yourself." It wouldn't change a thing.
"My cousin is a senior police officer," Samsun said, "so I have no worries."
Whoever she was playing the grande dame, which got up Pember's nose. Who did the old girl think she was?
"Inspector Çetin Ekmen is my cousin," Samson said.
The name made Sinem look up.
"What? Kerim's boss?" Pember said.
"Kerim?"
"He's Sinem's husband," Pember said. "Kerim Gürsel, Ekmen's sergeant."
"Oh," Samson said.
"Ah. So does Çetin Bey know that you are..."
"No, of course he doesn't," Pember said. "Why would he?" Samson shrugged. Her paste jewellery jingled in the sunlight.
"Well, he and I are friends," Samson said. "He walks with me on World AIDS Day every year in memory of my late partner."
She looked at Pember. "And although he might not quite get who his sergeant's wife really is, he'd know you, dear. As a chick with a dick myself, I can tell you that Ekmen knows his way around the world of the trans."
"Is that so?" Pember said.
"Yes."
"Well, Kerim Bey would rather keep his associations outside his work to himself. Know what I mean?"
Pember said. "So no telling Ekmen that his sergeant is married to a woman whose friends are transsexuals. Why would I?" Samson said.
"Just make sure that you don't," Pember said.
Samson raised her hands in submission.
"I won't," she said. "But I can assure you that my cousin is not the sort of man who'd just do as we tell you, eh?" Pember said.
Rita, who was sweating, rubbed her neck with a handkerchief and adjusted her choker to cover her Adam's apple. She didn't like scenes of any kind. She had thought that Pember might like someone with so much trans-life experience like Samson, but she hadn't reckoned on the shared connection via Pember's lover, Kerim. Awkward.
"She's running a temperature, and she wants her father,"
Nanny Mary said in that clipped, superior English of hers. Ahmed Erden rubbed his thumbs together, a nervous tick left over from childhood.
"You have called the doctor," he said.
"Of course. He prescribed antibiotics. It's a relatively mild infection, but it's in her intestines, and Kerim is in some pain. She does want you, Mr. Erden."
The Prime Minister had left the country, and there were insane rumours going about that the President might accede to some of the Gezi lunatic's demands. He wanted to get over to Sultan Ahmed. He'd seen Yanis Negroponte's face through one of the windows, and he was ready to crack. Ekmen's visit hadn't increased his confidence one iota. If he could just be leaned on for one or two more days...
"Mr. Erden, I must..."
"All right. All right."
He stood up.
"I'm sorry, but when a child is sick, only her parents will do," Mary said.
"Yes, yes."
He knew that. He loved Kelime with all his heart. She was his world. But spending time with her was hard. What conversation she had was about Barbie dolls, and there was a limit to the amount of time he could talk about those. she also repeated herself. And sometimes there were continence issues, usually when she wasn't well. He employed the Englishwoman to deal with these things. He wanted the best for Kelimi, the girl who ate everything she wanted and loved her daddy so very, very much. But he followed Mary to Kelimi's little pink bedroom. Usually it smelt of whatever perfume she liked, but this time there was an acidic twist of sickness on the air.
"Daddy!"
She put her fat, pink arms out towards him. Her face was flushed, and her long black hair was stuck to her head in thin, wet ribbons. Mary whispered, "Dr. Koch also said that Kelimi must have a change of diet. More roughage, and yes, yes." He sat down next to his daughter's pink bed, and then kissed her. Kelimi smiled.
"Daddy?"
Of course the girl needed a change of diet. She lived on ice cream, sweets, and little else. But what was he supposed to do? She wouldn't eat anything else, and if he tried to make her, she became so unhappy he couldn't bear it. Mary, he knew, tried to get her to take fruit and vegetables, but the tantrums she had to put up with were epic. He didn't want Kelimi to hate him. "How are you, my princess?" he asked.
"What a sore tummy."
He squeezed her hand. It was clammy. He needed to be in Sultan Ahmed, and then he wanted to be in Moda with Gulizar for the night.
"Don't go," Kelimi said.
Those eyes he found so strange and almost frightening at times stared down his soul.
"Dr. Koch said that Kelimi can't be left today," Mary said. "It will take 24 hours for the antibiotics to work."
Which was one of the many reasons why Ahmed Erden employed Miss Mary Cox, he thought. But that wasn't the point. Kelimi wanted him, and so she was going to have him. He smiled at his daughter and kissed her again. "Well, then, I'd better have a little bed made up for me in here, hadn't I?" His daughter giggled and shook with excitement. He hugged her. Once she was asleep, he'd leave. The Byzantine Empress Zoe had lived in the 9th century and had been born to the purple. This meant she had been a true daughter of a Byzantine emperor. In common with the Ottoman dynasty, the Byzantines had suffered from occasional outbreaks of pretenders to the throne, as well as heirs that lacked legitimacy in some way. But Zoe was not one of them. Beautiful and clever, Zoe ruled alongside three husbands and her sister, Theodora, who she hated. Her first marriage didn't take place until she was 50, and in her final marriage to Constantine the 9th, Zoe had been part of a ménage à trois with her husband's mistress. As she aged, so she sought to look younger, and the elderly Zoe was well known to brew up fertility potions and skin creams in order to remain beautiful. Some of her subjects called her a witch. No wonder Ariadne Sava had been so fascinated by this woman. Igmen rubbed his eyes and looked away from his computer screen. According to her colleagues, Ariadne Sava's greatest ambition had always been to write a book about Zoe. But as far as he could see, she hadn't even made a start. There had been copious notes on her system, but no sign of any coming together of ideas. And her notebook had been silent on the subject of Zoe. That had been about this unknown building and Constantine Palaiologos. She'd been knocked off course and hadn't told anyone.
"Breakfast! Can't I get breakfast?"
Igmen raised his eyes to the ceiling. By the sound of it, they were dragging some drunk along the corridor outside his office.
"You know that food's the best thing to have after a lot of drink."
There were scuffles, and something thudded against his door. He hoped it wasn't the man's head. Some of his colleagues could be less than gentle with drunks. He decided to check the situation. When he opened his office door, he saw two young constables holding up a man whose feet, one real and one false, dragged uselessly on the floor. One of the officers had a fist raised, ready to hit the man.
"Ah, don't be a mindless moron," Igmen said to the lad. "Just because he's drunk, don't use that as an excuse to Chitin Bey!"
The voice of the drunk wasn't familiar, but the face, even through the bruising and the cuts, was.
"It's me, Nuritin, from Gizli Tepe."
And then he smiled, revealing more broken teeth than he'd had when Eggman had first seen him. "Ah, Nuritin Bey," Eggman said. "What are you doing here with us this fine morning?" Then he turned back to the officers. "Bring him into my office." "We've been fighting, sir," one of the young men said. "Yes, alcoholics do that sometimes, and he's homeless, so things happen," Eggman said. The constables reluctantly took him into Eggman's office and pushed him into a chair. "So," Eggman repeated, "Nuritin Bey, what have you been doing?"
I had a few drinks."
The constables left, one of them with some reluctance, Eggman noticed. Everyone was anxious about street unrest in the light of Gezi. Eggman closed his office door. "What happened?" he said. Nuritin shrugged.
"I got arrested fighting a fish seller in the Balik Bazaar last night."
"Because you'd had more raka than was good for you?" He shrugged again.
"Because the fishman told lies about me," he said. "That I've been smashing glasses into people's faces. It wasn't true. I didn't do that, and I'm fed up with people telling lies about me."
Eggman locked his office door, opened his window, and offered the man a cigarette. Nuritin took it, and they both lit up.
"Who tells lies about you, Nuritin?" Eggman asked.
"Well, Jibrail Bey, for a start," he said.
"Jibrail Bey?" "Our landlord. Told that big Ahmed Erdin that none of us tenants had paid our rent for months, and that he could just evict us whenever he wanted to. It was convenient for Erdin to believe him, and so we all had to go. But Jibrail Bey saved his worst spite for me. He told Erdin that I was an alcoholic and an unbeliever. So every time he or his men saw me, they chased me away like a mad dog."
He shook his head. "I have a problem with drink from time to time, Chitin Bey. I'm human. I sin. But I am no atheist, and with me, for all my faults, what you see is what you get."
Eggman smiled. Ariadne Sava had been fond of Nuritin and his colleagues from Gizli Tepe, and he could see why. Nuritin leaned across Eggman's desk, flicking ash into the old, old saucer the policeman used as an ashtray.
"Ahmed Erdin has a mistress," he said. "A prostitute."
Eggman wasn't surprised. He was never surprised when someone who set him or herself up as a paragon of virtue had feet of clay, but he was very interested.
"Really? How do you know?" "Ariadne," he said.
Eggman sat up straight. "Dr. Sava?"
"Yes."
"How did she know?" Nuritin shrugged.
"People know. This is Istanbul. No secret can be buried here forever."
"Did Dr. Sava tell you anything about Erdin's mistress? Who she is? Where she lives?"
"No, she wouldn't. Said, the less we knew, the better. So how I think she was maybe trying to use what she knew about his mistress to get Erdin to rehouse us," Nuritin said.
"Blackmail him.
Call it what you like. But that was a long time ago. Months. And she never showed me any proof, so it may be true. It may not be."
"But you believe it?"
"Yes. Why not? People like him with money to burn, why not have a mistress? He gives money to all sorts of charities. He probably thinks God won't notice. I don't know. But Chitin Bey, I have no proof, and Ariadne never showed me any. I've thought that maybe he killed her to silence her. But why would he do that? People like him are untouchable, whatever they've done these days. Why take the risk of killing her? Just to call her a liar would have been enough."
He was right, but Eggman was still intrigued. Being as corrupt as a mass grave and treating your workmen like slaves was one thing, but getting embroiled in sexual misadventures, to many of the conservatively minded, was something else. That was dirty, and could taint Erden's image as the sad widower and saintly father of a damaged child, which he had so carefully cultivated. But could he have killed to preserve that image? And was Eekman's own view of Erden being coloured by the cruel mind games played at the Negroponte family's expense? It was hard. Midday, and the more empty-than-usual streets of Sultan Ahmed oscillated in the heat haze. Even so, the Negroponte house was locked, shuttered, and had its windows closed. Behind one, hidden by a thick, dusty net curtain, Yanis sat on a wooden chair looking out into the street. For what seemed like hours, he didn't do so much as twitch. Then he said, "He's not coming. Not now. Why not?" Naka, halfway through darning a sock, looked up.
"I don't know. Maybe he'll come later."
"No, he always comes before midday," Yanis said. "Has he given up?"
"How should I know? Would he give it a rest?"
Men like Ahmed Erden didn't give up. He was simply doing something else. That was the only reason he wasn't sitting outside in his car.
"What do you think Inspector Eekman thought of the house?" Yanis said.
"Madam always allowed the children who visited to have the run of the house," Aka said. "Nikos Bey and Madam had to wait for a child of their own for some years. But in the meantime she filled the house with other people's children. Jekin Bey's mother was her seer. A strange woman, but she knew things."
"What?"
"I don't know. What passed between Aisha Hanum and Madam was for them alone. But the Albanian predicted the tragedy of 1955. That I do know."
Yanis shook his head, and then went back to looking out of the window again. The call to prayer broke the silence. It was loud in the old city these days, the numerous muezzins' calls amplified through high-volume loudspeakers. Yanis watched as people began to walk towards the Blue Mosque and the prayer area behind Hagia Sophia. He still remembered what you had to do. In grey mosques in Hanover and in the small prayer room at the Volkswagen plant. It had been second nature. Now it made him shudder.
Aka said, "In answer to your question, I imagine Chetin Bey would have found being escorted in this house different, but not odd. He is no longer a child, and he is a policeman. He wouldn't expect to wander at will."
"Who would?" "I thought I discerned shock on his face when I took him from the bathroom back to the salon. I saw him look past me into the kitchen."
"And so the kitchen is different," Aka said. "After all these years he would be expecting that. You overthink everything."
"Yes, but no other part of the house has changed."
Aka shrugged. "So what?"
Yanis turned away from the window.
"If Erden gets in here, what do you think he will see?"
"Only you can really know that," Aka said. "But while he isn't here, you should go and entertain the children with your tricks. I saw some boys at the gate this morning. When the weather has cooled later this afternoon, you can go out."
"What if Erden comes back? Who will look after my mother? Aren't you at the doctor's today?"
"Later, yes. But you need to get out. You're going mad. Do your tricks by the gate. Then if Erden arrives, you can slip back in and lock up," Aka said. "The little ones, if no one else, like what you do."
But Yanis didn't know. He did enjoy performing tricks and illusions for the local children, but ever since Erden had put pressure on, the joy seemed to have gone out of everything in his life, including even that. Eventually he said, "We'll see." And then he turned back to the window and looked out at the baking street. Iris was talking very intensely to a plain middle-aged woman in a headscarf about the Kurds.
"You see, that deputy from BDP was right," she was saying. "It's not about just individual rights, not now. It's about Kurdish rights and identity, yeah? But it's also about the rights of the lesbians and gays, young people, religious people, Christians, Jews, everybody in this country. We don't want to be told stuff. You know what I mean? We don't need to be told anything. We're adults, yeah?
The woman just nodded. Perry smiled. Back in Gezi, now that her shift had ended, she could see how much the protest had grown in just one day. Now people were coming from all over Istanbul to visit the tent city and to thank the protesters for standing up for the park. Some of the opposition political parties had tents, as well as Greenpeace. Some people reckoned that the protest had swollen to 100,000 people, and yet underneath all the carnival was a threat that was all too obvious. One man was selling gas masks, and others were selling guy masks, like the ones in that film, V for Vendetta. Lots of people were running around wearing them, looking creepy. And then there was the immediate vicinity outside the park. Beyond the tents were barricades, Toma water cannon, and more police than could be counted. She'd seen some when she'd arrived, staggering around the edge of Gezi, looking sleep-deprived. It was said that some of the protesters were giving them water, and that they were sleeping on their riot shields. A few, it was rumored, had expressed sympathy with the protest. But all the shops in the area had been boarded up, and Perry knew that it could all kick off again at any moment. She bought herself a can of peach juice and sat on the grass. At least Ermina was happier now she was back at work. But he still didn't like her visiting the park, even though he agreed with everything Gezi stood for. How couldn't he? Maybe this was finally the chance for all marginalized groups to get a real say. Even perhaps their own people. Everyone in Mardin knew about the snake goddess, the Sharmeran. Some of the Christians openly worshipped her alongside their own deities, but only a few had dedicated their lives just to her. The Munguns were one such family, as well as the father of a high-ranking local police inspector. But in spite of their successes and respectability, inequalities still remained, especially outside the walls of Mardin and away from the plains of Mesopotamia, where the Sharmeran lived in a deep, deep cave. Night began to draw in almost before Perry knew. She had to decide whether to go home, she was on an early shift the following day, or stay and listen to a group of young boys singing in Armenian. She decided to stay. Chapter 15. Mehmet Suleiman's mobile phone rang just once before he answered it. It was almost morning, and he hadn't slept all night. But Gonca was asleep, and he wanted her to stay that way. He'd picked a fight with her the previous evening, because he was bored, and he didn't want it to start all over again. He put the phone to his ear, got out of bed, and took the call in the bathroom. Suleiman? Inspector? He recognized the voice. Commissioner Tekir. What did she want at this hour? Madam? Suleiman, we have a situation that may or may not be suspicious, she said. An apparent suicide. He felt his heart sink. He wanted to have a case he could get his teeth into. Lack of meaningful work beyond the identity of a 1950s skeleton was making him crazy, and turning his eyes towards women who were not Gonca. Apparent? Looks like a suicide, but the attending officer isn't so sure. Why not? You'll have to let him explain, she said. I'd like you to go there. Dr. Sarkisian is already on his way. Madam? It's in Moda, I'm afraid, she said. So you'll have to catch a ferry. The local constabulary will pick you up from Kadikoy Pierhead. Against every feeling of disgust that rose up in his mind, he hoped the local officer was right, and it wasn't a suicide. Get back to me, Tekir said. Of course. She entered the call. Beyond Gonca's bedroom door, he could hear the rest of her family waking up and beginning to move about. Soon, all but her father and an old maid aunt would be off to Gezi Park in their brightest summer clothes, and that included Gonca. Not that he knew everything they did when they were there. Gonca, he knew, collected material for her collage art, but he suspected the others danced for money or sold flowers from the garden. He knew he was probably misjudging them, falling into every possible cliché that existed about Roma. But he didn't see Gonca's family as particularly politically engaged, in spite of their bad experiences with property developers. He had a quick shower, dressed, and went out into the cool morning air. The day was young. Balat looked shabbily beautiful, and for a moment he almost felt optimistic. If only he could have shared that feeling with his friend Çetin İkmen.
"Come on, get up," Fatma said. "The workmen are here."
İkmen had to struggle to get out of his dream. As soon as she'd consummated her first marriage, when she was 50, the Byzantine Empress Zoe had spent the next decade trying to get pregnant. She'd been to doctors, seers and sorcerers, visited the shrines of saints, and created potions and aphrodisiacs in the seclusion of her own bedchamber. All to no avail, except in İkmen's dream. In that, she'd had a child, the son she'd always dreamed about, child of a ruling empress born to the purple. Why the child had looked like his own son, Kemal, was probably because Fatma had spent much of the previous evening trying to persuade the boy to leave Gezi Park and come home. But he hadn't.
"Come on, come on," Fatma said, as she shooed him into the shower. "They want to turn the water off."
He got out of his apartment as soon as he could and wandered down to the old pudding shop for coffee and a cigarette outside in the weak early morning sunshine. Ever since he'd spoken to Nurettin, the rubbish picker, he'd been unable to think about much except the possible existence of Ahmet Erden's mistress. It made absolute sense that a good-looking, rich and powerful widower like him should have a woman in his life. İkmen couldn't and wouldn't condemn him for it, but he knew that some of those who had put Erden where he was today would. Was it really possible he had killed Ariadne Sava to silence her about this woman? And how had Sava found out about her? It seemed to İkmen that Ariadne Sava had been a woman ruled by great passions, for her work, her heritage, even for the rubbish pickers of Gizlitepe. But would she have put her life on the line for them? Considering the professional breakthroughs she seemed to have been making, this didn't make sense. Had Erden reacted in a way she hadn't anticipated? And if he had done so, why had he taken her child, if he'd taken it? İkmen went inside the pudding shop, got another coffee, and returned to his chair in the sunshine and the third cigarette of the day. Erden was well known to have a disabled daughter. Occasionally he displayed this girl in public, with an expression on his face, İkmen always thought, that looked halfway between pride and constipation. He obviously loved her, and would probably do anything he could to make her life pleasant and wealthy. And if Ariadne Sava had threatened that? Then why hadn't Erden just given the rubbish pickers some cheap, shonky old flats to live in and shut her up that way? That was what, according to Nurettin, she had wanted. But then that was bypassing the issue of Erden's character, which didn't allow for defeat. The Negropontes knew all about that. İkmen wanted to confront Erden, but knew he couldn't. Where was his proof for this mistress, outside the mind of a bitter alcoholic? Arto Sarkisian stood back from the bathtub and narrowed his eyes. "It isn't right," he said to Suleiman, "because I would expect far more blood." "There's blood in the water," Suleiman said. "Not enough. Remember, a small amount of blood goes a long way. And while I accept she was probably put in the water while she was still alive, she didn't survive for very long." A scene redolent of ancient Rome had greeted Kadikoy Sergeant Tunjel when he'd been called in the early hours of the morning to an apartment on Risa Pasha Sokak in the pretty waterfront district of Muda. A man en route to Ataturk Airport had found a neighbor's front door open. Fearing it had been broken into, he'd gone inside, where he'd found his neighbor, a Mrs. Ayşe Ocal, dead in her bath. Both wrists had been slit. "And then, of course, we come to the cuts, which are equally as deep on both arms. That's difficult to pull off, with the first arm weakened by the first cut," the Armenian said. "They run vertically up the arm as opposed to horizontally, which shows that the cutter knew what he or she was doing. But her heart had all but stopped when she entered the water."
"So she didn't cut her wrist in the bath?"
"No. Her heart was already beating its last by then," he said.
"What killed her? Did she kill herself?"
"I won't know until I can get her on the table, but I can see no sign of head injury or any other marks of the body
apart from the cuts to the arms.
Poison?
Maybe. Toxicology, as ever, is on my to-do list, he said. Sergeant Dunjell, a uniformed officer in his 40s, joined them.
Inspector?
Yes?
Otto Sarkisian saw the man flinch. Suleiman's manner had always been arrogant, but as he was getting older, it was becoming more exaggerated. But he was unhappy, which wasn't helping. Otto would have to have a word with Igmen and get him to end this feud between them. Hell would freeze over before Suleiman would make it up with him.
"Neighbors say the woman was a bit of a lively sort," Dunjell said. "Dressed very loud, if you know what I mean. Never covered her head."
"Managed to rouse the cabbager?"
Suleiman asked, referring to the building's concierge. Cabbagers usually knew just about everything about the people they served, including details of their private lives.
"Gone," Dunjell said.
"Gone? Where?"
"Gizzy, the neighbors think. Went about 3 days ago," Dunjell said.
"Then we'll need to find him."
He turned to the Armenian.
"How long do you think she's been dead, Doctor?"
"Given her condition and when she was discovered, a few hours ago at the most," he said.
"Did Mrs. Ojal live alone?"
Suleiman asked Dunjell.
"Yes, but a man visited."
"Always the same man?"
He shrugged.
"Find out."
"Yes, sir."
He went to leave, but Suleiman called him back.
"And find out what Mrs. Ojal did for a living, will you?"
"Sir."
"And I want this place searched, specifically looking for this woman's contacts. So computer systems, phones, address books, diaries, photographs?"
"Yes, sir."
He left. They both looked at the body in its pool of red-tinged water. Mrs. Ojal had been a large woman with wide hips and a narrow waist. Her breasts, which were also large, were very obviously enhanced by silicone implants. Naturally honey-brown-skinned, she had long, thick, dyed dark red hair. She looked either Eastern or foreign. As to her age, Otto had to say over 20, but how much over he really wouldn't know until he examined her properly. Then Suleiman said, "So, Doctor, would you concur with Sergeant Dunjell?"
"That this is a suicide?"
"No," he said. "Given what we can see here, I'd say murder is the most likely scenario."
"Okay. Thank you."
Suleiman turned away, but as he moved, Otto Sarkisian was horrified to catch sight of a smile on his face. He'd been there when Kelime had woken, which had been the main thing, but now Semih had called him and he had to go. Ahmet Erdin kissed his daughter on the head and left the house. Some bastards in Gizli Tepe had attacked the site overnight, and he had to go and assess the damage. Animals! Why did they fail to realize that it was people like him who were turning their Istanbul into a world city? Why did they want to live in hideous old slums? He drove south to the Bosphorus Bridge, which was at a standstill, and then just moved forward centimeter by centimeter until he got to the Asian side. Why all the crazies had come out to oppose a new third Bosphorus Bridge, he just couldn't fathom. So it had been decided to name it after a particularly punitive sultan, so a few hectares of trees would have to be sacrificed. If nothing was done, the city would come to a standstill. He turned right towards Kadıköy and Gizli Tepe. He had wanted to get to the Negroponte house, but his brother had insisted he look at the Gizli Tepe damage first.
"It's a disgrace," he said. "All the windows in the lower part of one tower have been broken, and what looks like feces smeared all over the equipment."
He'd called the police, such as they were. Most of them were up at Gezi Park, and, apparently, there'd been a murder, too. The dregs of the police world had turned up, according to Simi. How could second-rate old men hope to catch anything other than a cold? Erdin put his hand on the briefcase on the passenger seat. He'd had his lawyer draw up a contract for the Negropontes, which, although it was for far more money than he had wanted to pay, had to be for an amount that would finally impress them. But if that didn't work, he'd take Yanis to one side and tell him what he'd done after he'd scratched his hand with Yanis's blood and skin. That would be a gamble, because there was always a chance that Yanis really was who he claimed to be. But Ahmed doubted it.
He'd heard the way the old man Harker spoke to him, seen how he looked at him, too, with suspicion. There were, it was said, over 100,000 people in Gezi Park, and the politicians the Prime Minister had left behind when he went on his North African trip appeared to be trying to appease them. There were now protests similar to Gezi in Ankara, Izmir, Adana, all over the country. If they brought the government down, they'd bring him down with them, and then he'd never get the Negroponte house. He'd never be able to fulfill his promise to his father. It wasn't easy trying to second-guess where a disgruntled Carpenter would be in a crowd of over 100,000 people. Jaffa Ayan was a small man in late middle age, with grey hair and a thick moustache. How many millions of those were in the city? All Umar Mungun really had to distinguish the Carpenter of Aysel Ojal's apartment in Moda from the common herd of disappointed middle-aged Turkish men was that he had a limp. He'd lost his right leg in the Cyprus War of 1974. What had replaced it was apparently made of metal. None of the residents had known anything more about Mr. Ayan. Divorced and childless, apparently he was a miserable man, addicted to daytime television and, some speculated, pornography. According to Suleiman, Aysel Ojal had been a handsome woman. Had Ayan decided to murder her after she had rebuffed his advances? If he'd ever made any advances? Ayan's story, according to his residents, was that he'd left the apartment block 3 days before, after having a row with a man on the fourth floor, known for his piety. It had started because Ayan had wanted to have the radio on when he washed the apartment staircases. The man on floor four had said he found the music offensive. They'd argued. Ayan had told the man to fuck off, and then he'd yelled that he was off to Gezi and fuck them all at the top of his voice. The woman Suleiman and Dr. Sarkisian had found with her wrist slit in her bath had died, the pathologist reckoned, at the earliest at 10 p.m. the previous evening, well after Ayan had left the building. But had he gone back at some point? And if so, why? There was no evidence at all to suggest that Ayan had ever had designs on Aysel Ojal. In fact, one resident had said that it was only Ayan who ever spoke to the man who sometimes came to visit Mrs. Ojal. That was why they needed to find him. Umar looked down at the one picture he had of Ayan, and found himself thinking that he looked like his father. "Umar, who's that?" Perry pointed at the photograph. They had met, as agreed, by the Greenpeace tent. "Someone we need to question," he said. "Shouldn't you be at work?" "Just finished. I was on an early." "You know, Umar, nobody's going to help you find anyone here." He frowned. "I mean, how many officers are lurking like death outside this park with their gas canisters and water cannon?" "I'm not here to arrest this man, only to talk to him," Umar said. "Yes, right." "No, really." He took her arm and led her off the path and over to a more secluded area. He showed her the photograph again. "A woman was found murdered in her apartment this morning in Moda," he said. "This man is the carpenter of her building. 3 days ago he left to come and camp out here." "Oh, so he can't... We don't think he killed her, not at the moment," Umar said. "But the woman had a lover. Nobody in the building knew who he was or ever spoke to him, except this carpenter, Jaffar Ayan. We need to find this boyfriend, as you can imagine, and this man Ayan is the only lead we have." "So what are you doing?" Perry said. "Just looking around. There's three of us, including Inspector Ekmen's sergeant." "Kerim Gürsel?" "You'll be flattered you remembered his name. But Perry, he is married." She waved a dismissive hand. "I don't need man trouble in my life. I've enough problems with a little brother." "If I could, I'd ID-check every man here," Umar said. "But given the situation and the mood, that would not go down well," she said. "So hence the stupid sneaking about after a man who has no friends, no family, and his only distinguishing characteristic is a limp." Perry crossed her arms over her chest and looked at her younger brother. He was clearly tired and looked crushed. She got the impression that his boss had used him badly and hard much of the time. Although Suleiman had always been the soul of gallantry to her, she didn't like him, because she didn't like it when Umar looked like a whipped dog. "Well, you know what you need, don't you, Omer?" she said.
"What's that? Divine intervention?"
"Failing that?"
"No."
"You need allies," she said. "You need people who can walk through these crowds looking for a man with a limp without sticking out like you do in your suit and tie and shiny shoes. Omer, I have made friends here. Some of them are very colourful and flamboyant, and some are not. But they all fit here, and when I tell them that you need their eyes and ears to help you solve a murder, I'm sure they'll forgive you for being part of an establishment that wants to cut down innocent trees." She smiled. "Maybe." Then Irma's phone rang. A junior researcher in a white coat, a kid by the look of him, brought tea for them both. When he'd gone, Eileen Akyildiz closed her office door. "Ariadne and I worked together," she said, "but I never knew what she did in her leisure time." She never mentioned her work with the rubbish pickers of Gizli Tepe, or the name Ahmed Erdin to you, Igmen said.
"No, and believe me, I would have known if she had talked about Erdin. My husband is an architect, and he goes on about his buildings all the time."
"In what sense?"
"He hates them," she said. "Says they're unimaginative and poorly constructed."
"How does Erdin come into the rubbish pickers of Gizli Tepe? I thought he knocked their homes down to build some tower blocks."
"He did," Igmen said, "which was why Dr. Sava had issues with him."
She frowned. "Dr. Sava befriended the rubbish pickers and tried to get Erdin, who had thrown them out of their homes, to rehouse them," Igmen said. "Because they were only ever tenants, as opposed to owner-occupiers, he didn't strictly owe them anything. But they were, and are, homeless, and Dr. Sava felt sorry for them. She made representation to Erdin on their behalf, which he apparently took badly."
Eileen Agildas drank some tea.
"In what way?"
"It is alleged that he threatened her. With what, I don't know. That's why I am speaking to her colleagues and friends," Igmen said.
She shook her head. "I wish I could help you, but I don't know anything."
She sighed. "And now they have taken Constantine Paleologos to the museum."
"Oh?"
She looked very unhappy. At Professor Bozdov's very apparent anger at what Sava and Akyildiz had been doing without him finally resulted in his taking over the entire project. "I knew I'd have to surrender him to the museum eventually, but my researches were not complete," she said. "What can you do? Ariadne should have shared her find with the museum, I know that. And anyway, there were other factors involved."
"What other factors?"
She looked as if she was struggling with something. Then she said, "Look, I know that maybe I should have told you, but for the last week I've been getting death threats."
"If you've been getting death threats, you should definitely have told me," Igmen said.
"What kind of death threats?"
"Relating to the body," she said. "Paleologos. Posting emails about how, if I don't stop working on the body, I will be killed. Religious nonsense about how the body of an infidel king should be destroyed. What scared me most was how they knew. As far as I know, it's only myself, you and Professor Bozdow's team at the museum, who know that the alleged emperor even exists."
"Unless Dr. Sava told someone. Her lover? The father of her child? If we could locate him, then maybe we could find the baby. We've got uniformed officers interviewing men convicted of child abuse. I've even spoken to a woman who stole a baby from Yeselkoy 35 years ago."
"Nothing." "Are you sure you never saw her with a man, Dr. Agildas?"
She shook her head. "I've racked my brains, but I can't think of anyone," she said. "I knew so little about her."
"And yet her child had to have a father." What also passed through Igmen's mind was that maybe Professor Bozdow or someone in his team had sent the death threats to get hold of the body for themselves. But they hadn't needed to do that. As Dr. Agildas had said, Ariadne should have shared the body with them when she'd first found it.
They had a right to study those bones. "I'd like to see those emails and letters, if you still have them," Igmen said.
"I do, but our IT guy said that it was impossible to trace the emails,
Well, let's let our IT people have a look at them, Eggman said. And with the letter, maybe we can get some fingerprints or DNA.
Okay, she said.
He left with two word-processed letters and a stack of printed emails. They were standard religious fanatic fare, littered with words like infidel, unbelievers, and unclean. They could have come from almost any monomaniac, or not. Although Dr. Argyllos had been wrong not to take these documents straight to the police, she had been right to be scared. Nobody at the museum would have spoken to anyone outside the institution about Palaiologos. If he was who Dr. Sava thought he was, then he could be a jewel in their academic crown, and they all cared about what they did. What was particularly worrying was why Dr. Argyllos had only received death threats since Dr. Sava's death. Did that mean anything? One scenario that Eggman couldn't shift from his mind was that Ariadne Sava had told her killer about her find to try and save her own and her baby's lives. But that assumed that he or she would be interested in Palaiologos. Maybe if she had been murdered, it was so that her killer could gain access to the body. Maybe that had been his or her plan all along. But then why kill Sava when Argyllos was the one who actually had Palaiologos in her possession? Chapter 16. It was after midnight, and although the vast, ugly house was shut up for the night, a row of pink and green fairy lights around the front door merrily flashed on and off. Willem Tekke pushed the doorbell again, and tried to imagine what would be inside this house, which looked like a frosted wedding cake. Vast, gilded sofas sitting on expensively cheap-looking carpets, and more leather than a herd of bulls, probably. At her side she heard Mehmet Suleiman clear his throat. There were five of them outside Ahmet Erden's Bebek house. Tekir, Suleiman, Irma Mungun, and two uniforms. A ridiculously overblown display of manpower for just one person. It seemed stupid that someone of her seniority was there at all. But Erden, whatever he had or hadn't done, was powerful, and that, if nothing else, had to be taken into account and respected. A young man, bleary-eyed and wearing old-man-style candy-striped pyjamas, opened the door. Tekke held up her ID.
"Police," she said. "We want to speak to Mr. Ahmet Erden."
"He's in bed."
"What? Who are you?" Tekke asked.
"I'm his brother."
"Get him up, then, Mr. Erden," Tekke said. "Tell him we need to speak to him." She looked at the two uniforms. "You, round the back."
"What do you want to speak to him for?"
"That's between us and your brother. Now, are you going to get him up, or am I?" Tekke said.
The young man, who had to be semi-Erden by Tekke's reckoning, led the three of them into the house and took them through to a large modern lounge. They all took their shoes off. Then the young man went to fetch his brother. Tekir, Suleiman, and Ömer Mungun stood on a shocking pink carpet the size of a swimming pool and tried to look anywhere that wasn't lurid. Eventually, Suleiman said, "I'm speechless." But then they all stayed silent until Ahmet Erden appeared. Although clearly just roused, he looked alert and even groomed in his faux karate suit pajamas.
"What do you want?"
He addressed Tekke and only her, as she had known he would.
"We'd like to know where you were last night between 9 p.m. and 2 a.m., she said.
"I was here," he said. "Why?"
"Can anyone corroborate that?"
"What, that I was here?" "I imagine so," he said. "My daughter was sick yesterday, and so I stayed here at home all day and all night."
"I trust your daughter is better now."
"Yes, much. However, she is a minor." Tekke smiled. "Were any adults in the house last night? Your brother?"
Semi Erden had not returned with his brother.
"No, but my daughter's English nanny, Mary Cox, was here."
"Then we'll need to speak to her," Tekke said.
"Is she here now?"
"Yes, what's this about?" he said. "Why do you want to know where I was last night? What's happened?"
"Mr. Erden, would you please go and wake Mary Cox?" Tekke said. She looked at Ömer Mungun. "Sergeant, would you please accompany Mr. Erden?"
"Yes, madam,"
Accompany me? Ahmed Erdin's face flushed. What do I need him with me for?
He moved towards Dekker and pushed his face into hers.
What's this about, Commissioner? Have you come to